Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Phoebe dropped a hot big peen joke and she was like, ah, shit. And then she was a fan. I don't know why this had to come any other way.
From Topic Studios and WarnerMedia Podcast Network, this is Politically Reactive. I'm W. Kamau Bell.
And I'm your South Indian sweetheart, Hari Kondabolu.
Wait, Hari, are you related to the vice president-elect?
Wait, Kamau, are you related to the vice president-elect? I mean, think about it. Kamala Harris, Kamau Hari. That could not be a coincidence.
Once again, we're two comedians on an impossible mission, trying to figure out American politics.
Is that easier now that this election is over, or harder, you might be wondering? It's just as hard.
Again, we're talking to the people doing the hard work to expand and hopefully reinvent our democracy.
And sometimes that means taking on the traditions of American democracy that don't make sense anymore, if they ever did.
James Madison, in the middle of the convention in July, he comes out and he says, look, I think a popular vote for president would be the best way to do it. We would choose the fittest leader that way. The South will never go for it. And he says this, quote, on account of the Negroes.
That's Jesse Wegman, who breaks down the history of the Electoral College and demolishes the arguments in favor of it in his new book, Let the People Pick the President.
What a radical idea. Are votes counting? What is this, ancient Athens?
This time, the candidate who got the most votes will actually end up in the White House. What a country. But unless Georgia elects two Democratic senators on January 5th, it's going to be an uphill battle on a lot of stuff, including making one person, one vote a reality.
And that's why we're talking to Megan Hatcher-Mays, Director of Democracy Policy for Indivisible. She thinks that even without a Senate majority, Democrats can take action to expand voting rights. And she is pissed at Dianne Feinstein.
We'll also take a break from politics with our good friend, dope queen, stand-up comic, and best-selling author, Phoebe Robinson.
You know, and she's been taking it easy in 2020, launching a literary imprint, starting a new podcast, hosting an Amazon comedy special, and keeping in touch with her dear friend, Michelle Obama.
Wait, did you just say, hit up Mish?
Yeah, hit up Mish. That's her nickname, it's Mish.
It's all coming up on Politically Reactive. Right, Har?
Yeah, Cam. Hey, Kamau, you excited? Joe Biden won the presidential election, according to everyone in the world, except the president of the United States.
That makes it a little awkward. Because, I would say according to the president of the United States and some Republicans who are still kissing his butt, even though his butt is about to be removed from the White House.
This is the first White House squatter. This has never happened before. And here's the thing, if they do get him out, which I assume at some point they will drag him out, you got to check all his suitcases, you got to check any boxes, because he's going to take shit. He's in debt. He's in a lot of debt. He's going to take some shit. It's going to end up at Sotheby's. That's what's going to happen.
Yeah, he's going to be like, what, I thought this Winston Churchill bust was mine. I didn't bring this with me? I was hoping that all the Republican leadership would just slowly back out of the room, but they've decided, I think they realize that without Trump, they basically have no identity. Like, well, there's no Republican leader who has that kind of connection to the base of the Republican Party. So when he goes, it's like they know that there's going to be a big sucking noise out of the White House and this country.
Well, they're also they also know that the Democrats are a bunch of cowards who are not going to really. They'll talk, but they're not going to make more noise than that. Like, they're weak. And it's clear they're weak because, you know, Biden has kind of sort of been elected for a week, maybe. Mm. And they're already talking about moderation. Joe Biden has to be. And initially, when I hear that, I'm like, what's this? John Kasich saying some shit. And then you find out, no, it's like Democrats in the party on a call who are, like, pissed off about defunding the police and Black Lives Matter. And it's like, Trump and his assholes did not talk about moderation. McConnell has not been moderating anything. We're not even in power yet. Mm-hmm. And they're already talking about, let's tone down the rhetoric.
Yes.
Like, are you fucking kidding me?
I think that's, well, that's the thing. Time will tell, because I think that is a certain part of the Democratic Party. But I don't think, you know, I think there's the Katie Porters of the world, the AOCs, the Ilhan Omars. I think they're just waiting. Just like, I think there's clearly going to be a power struggle in the Democratic Party over the next 4 years or so. I'm here for it. I'm excited about it, because I think that, as we'll talk about later with your friend Megan, there are different strains of the Democratic Party, and I think that I'm here for the younger strain to take over. And they're with the shits, as they say. So, Hurry, I wanted to welcome you to a new thing that you're not familiar with, because it's let's be clear, Kamala Harris is a lot of things. She's the first Black woman who's the vice president. She's also the first Indian American woman who's the vice president.
South Indian at that.
South Indian, okay. Which does that mean? I'm afraid to ask any questions about that as follow up to either appear ignorant or to stoke flames. I shouldn't.
Well, it's the same country. It's not like.
But is it like what does it mean to be South Indian versus to be Northern Indian? Is it the same as America, where the South Indians are?
It's actually the
Confederate flag believers.
South India generally has more universities. It's known for like being more of a. Educational power center.
It's the opposite of America.
Yeah, it's like the South is not. I mean, we're darker skinned, and so that certainly is used as a disadvantage.
Yeah.
It's a mixed. It depends. I know that when I've been to North India, people know I'm South Indian. At times, that's led to people not being as nice to me.
Wow.
Oh,
racism. So here, this is what I want to welcome you to. When you have somebody who is in the White House, who's a member of your group, and then they experience racism, then you get to experience that racism, and they become a lightning rod for racism. So Kamala Harris she's not even the vice president yet. She's vice president-elect. But shortly after she became vice president-elect, a member of the House of Lords, and his name sounds so House of Lords, his name is Lord Kilclooney, he tweeted, "What happens if Biden moves on and the Indian becomes president?
Jesus
who then becomes
Christ.
Vice president?"
My God.
So I like that the racism is embedded in a question that he could Google. what happens if Biden moves on and the Indian becomes president? Who then becomes vice president? That's really your question? Is that your question? He just wanted to say the Indian. And then when people push back on him about it, he deleted the tweet and he said that he's like, I only learned about who she was 3 days ago.
Oh, get out of here. Everyone is following the American election everywhere else. I don't mean that to be cocky. It's because you guys are scared to death as to what's going to happen if this maniac gets reelected.
He said, I did not know her name and identified her with the term Indian.
That's so, first of all, the Indian, you figure it out. You can Google it. You can ask anybody in your office, ask any human being on the street, you're a liar. Secondly, that was probably one of two tweets, and he deleted it before he put the second one up. Like, who's going to be vice president if the Indian takes office? And the next tweet was probably, I guess, a monkey. I assume that's it. I assume that's where it was going to go.
So, welcome to what having Barack Obama in office was for me. Like, every day you just open the newspaper like, oh, damn it. Like, just extra racism. You get a scoop of extra racism.
Who's vice president? Mowgli? Another member of the Jungle Book?
So, yeah, I just wanted to welcome you to that.
Can I talk about Kamala Harris just a little bit more?
Sure.
Just because a few things. I mean, first of all, I find it amazing that obviously she's half Black, half Indian, just because of the amount of anti-Black racism in my community. So there's something really beautiful about her existence. I like the fact that when you have the older generation say something about never date a Black person, you can say, what, our children will become vice president then? What's the problem? You know, I just think it's symbolically, it's so meaningful. And I do understand the significance, her being a South Indian, Black American woman, children of two immigrants. I realize how important that is. Mm-hmm. Let me also say, I also realize the importance of Trump being out of office and Joe Biden being president, getting Trump out. I get that. But that does not mean that we can't criticize them.
Uh-oh.
It was annoying when people were saying that shit before the election, as if me tweeting critical things about, like, when Biden talks about institutional racism, like, yeah, he should know he helped create it. Like, that's the fucking truth. And the idea that we're not supposed to criticize our leaders, if you keep criticizing them, then a Republican is going to be elected. What the hell are you talking about? Like, get the fuck. And look, I understand, you know, the importance of you know, Kamala Harris in particular as a symbol in terms of what she represents. She did some fucked up shit, though, when she was attorney general. And I understand the importance of Biden, but at the same time, he did some fucked up shit, and he's talking about moderation already, bringing Republicans on board. I mean, this is what I'm talking about. Like, the work starts now. If you think that it's over, you have not learned a fucking thing from the last 4 years. We need to change things from the bottom up. This is not the answer. Joe Biden certainly wasn't my pick. I wanted him to win, but he certainly wasn't the guy I thought was going to lead us to the next stage. It's up to us then to push even harder to get the Senate back. But if you're going to be stupid enough to say, don't criticize the president, you know, as if he's a fucking king, you haven't learned a goddamn thing from the last 4 years. Because, you know, we're not even going to be back to normal. We're working to get back to normal. And once we get back to normal, normal sucked. Normal still had issues. So, like, we had a day to celebrate. Fine. Let's get back to work, motherfuckers.
So there's a Senate runoff in Georgia. There are two Senate seats up for grabs because in Georgia, apparently, when you run for Senate, you have to get, like, you have to get just over 50% of the vote, like 50% of the vote plus one. The four people who ran did not get that. So now there's two Senate runoffs, and Stacey Abrams, the person who brought us Georgia turning blue, is now in charge of, I don't know if she's in charge, but she's now trying to help the Democratic candidates win. So Reverend Warnock, Raphael Warnock is running for Senate. And so John Ossoff, they're both running for Senate seats. And it's important that they win, because if they win, then it looks like that there will be that Republicans and Democrats will each have 50 seats, and then Kamala will be the tiebreaker. I assume she'll go with the Democrats. That will get us closer to these sort of big changes, like expanding the court and expanding voter rights and Medicare for all. So we need these two seats. So there is a website, gasenate.com. That is Stacey Abrams. That's her website she's got set up for this, gasenate.com, where you can donate to Georgia Democrats. You can donate to each candidate. Do whatever you need to do. Make it happen. Spread the word, gasenate.com, because that's, like you said, Hurry, we can celebrate for a day, but it's already time to get back to work. And one of those big things that we need to change in this country is something called the Electoral College.
Yep.
So the first interview we're doing on this episode is talking to author Jesse Wegman about abolishing the Electoral College. And for me, I just want to be clear about this. This is a big thing for me, abolishing the Electoral College, because, and we've had some controversy on this show before about this, and if you know, you know, and if you don't, you can go read the back issues. But as a Californian, I voted for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but I kind of did it just to, like, throw one more log on the fire. Like, it was just sort of like, you know, I was not afraid of California turning red. And I would rather that my vote counted. And so I'm super excited that we can finally talk about it.
And then we're going to spend a little time with our friend Phoebe Robinson. She's got a new podcast called Black Frasier out. She started a literary imprint. She's hosting an end of the year Amazon comedy special. She bought my son a crib.
And after Phoebe, we'll check in with Megan Hatcher-Mays of Indivisible. She's got ideas about what Democrats can do in 2021. Even without controlling the Senate, although we're going to work on that controlling the Senate thing. But first, let's dive deep into the ugly history, and I mean ugly, and hopefully brief future of the Electoral College.
Jesse Wegman is a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College.
Jesse, thank you for doing the podcast. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I don't know if you get this a lot, but we are so excited to talk about the Electoral College.
Oh my God, yes. Yes.
My publisher thought that might be the case, which is why I got to write a book about it.
I mean, I think it's important that people understand it because it doesn't make any sense. So,
well, you know, one of the things that amazed me was when I thought about the idea in the first place a few years ago, I went back sort of into the archives, and it was hard to find any book written for a general audience about this topic, which feels pretty central to our government, to me, the way we choose our president. So I was more than happy to try to tackle it and address a lot of the misunderstandings that I think people on all sides of the political spectrum have about how it works.
When I think of the Electoral College, when I first really started to understand it, I started to understand it as obsolete slaveholder math. Am I right? Is that the right direction?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The Electoral College was part of a design of government that was put in place by a group of men, many of whom were slaveholders themselves, and even those who weren't realized that they were being effectively extorted by the slaveholding states in the South to give those states more power, right? So the Three-Fifths Clause was the deal that they felt they had to strike in order to keep the Constitution alive. And that deal gave the Southern slaveholding states extra power for their slaves, right? People who had no voting rights, no human rights at all, and yet count towards the Southern states' representation in Congress. So when you create an electoral college that replicates that congressional representation, they get the same power there. It was probably 12 to 14 extra electoral votes. So you see this, what they called the slave power, playing out throughout the first decades of American history.
And it's funny to say it gives the slaves more power, but it's not power they're allowed to use themselves.
Oh, no, I mean, it gives the slaveholding states that power. I'm sorry if I misspoke.
No. I think it's just, I just wanted to be clear about, like, that. Like, more power for their holdings, not for the actual, not for the
exactly.
Actual
people. And you know, the framers from the North said, you know, wait a minute, you know, your count, that's property. How are you counting it, you know, towards your representation? I have a few thousand cows up here in New Hampshire. You know, why can't I count them? So they were really mad about it.
The guys on the North don't sound as great as we thought they would.
No, they sound pretty awful too.
They were making the point
that if you're going to treat people as property, you can't also count them toward your representation in Congress. But
technically true, Hurry. They are technically making a good point, a painful point.
I don't think they were comparing slaves to cows, but they were you know.
Sure, they were though. I'm pretty sure.
I'm sure some of them. Yes.
That yeah. Would be.
It sounds like basically the slaveholders of the South were also involved in extortion. like we have this, the North felt like we have to respond to their demands because they have because they're basically our industry. They're the seat of the industry of this country, right?
Oh, they called it extortion at the convention. There was no doubt about this. You know, this is what's funny is like, you know, for a lot of American history until like the last few decades, we really just whitewashed, and I use that term, intentionally, the role that slavery played in the creation of our system of government and in our Constitution. But the framers weren't hiding it. They were completely open about it. You know, when we talk about what was the method that they would adopt of electing the president, James Madison, in the middle of the convention in July, he comes out and he says, look, I think a popular vote for president would be the best way to do it. We would choose the fittest leader that way. The South will never go for it. And he says this, quote, on account of the Negroes. This was not a secret to the framers themselves. They were completely happy to talk openly about it. You know, they didn't include the word slavery in the Constitution, which was a concession to the South. I think that it's interesting that for so much of our history, we essentially erased it. And thanks to the work of some really dogged historians and legal scholars and activists over the last several decades in particular, that the reality of what was happening at that convention and in the early years of the Republic has come to light.
So the other thing I want to say is that Hurry's got all the degrees. He's going to get into the deep dive stuff, but he's going to get all the smart stuff. You guys will have that conversation. I'll eat my cereal that's here. Whenever you talk to somebody about dismantling or abolishing the Electoral College, dismantling, however you want to put it, there's always the people who defend it, and they can be in the North, South, East, West. I've talked to people who like high-level people in like political campaigns who I think would be down with it. Democrats who I think would be down with it are like, oh, no, 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 no. And it's a whole thing about like if you let each American's vote count is one, you're giving the population centers too much power. But I'm like, but then isn't the reverse happening if you do it through the Electoral College?
Right. I mean, Yes, of course. Right now, the less populated parts of the country have a bonus in the Electoral College. It's actually not as much of a bonus as you would think. It's the real bonus for the small states, of course, is the Senate. And that is that's a bias that is only getting worse as people do cluster more in a few very large population states. But that that has long been one of the reasons that people oppose the Electoral College, and I think it's misguided on a few levels. One is, I think people just simply miscalculate how big cities are, right? How big the population centers are. If you break the country into four rough categories, which is, urban core, the big cities, suburbs, exurbs, which are, exurbs in small towns is a category, and then the rural areas, you almost exactly break the country into four equal quarters. So, a quarter of Americans live in each of those four groups. One of those groups, the big cities, is not going to dominate the other three. It just isn't going to happen. It never has happened, and it won't happen. I think, that's a statistical, a mathematical misunderstanding that a lot of people have, that the big states are way bigger than they actually are. But I think what you're getting at is this other point, which is, when you think about political equality, that's the idea of the one person, one vote ideal, right? Which now does apply, but thanks to the Supreme Court, to all of our legislative elections, right? Your state lawmakers and Congress, but not to the election of the president. You think about that ideal and you say, wait, why doesn't that apply to the election of the president? That's the one office where the occupant has to represent everybody equally. And yet we're not counted equally. We're effectively gerrymandered, So I think that's a really good question is, regardless of where people live, they should count the same in choosing the leader of the country.
I'm really trying to understand how this all could have happened, because there's no other democracy in the world that has a system like this, right? There is no electoral college anywhere else.
Finland had one for a few decades, but they got rid of it.
This is dumb.
It was an American trend. It was an American fad they realized was not going to last.
Look, we'll just keep hip-hop in the movies, but we're going to let this one go back.
The framers were brilliant political scientists of their day. They were really insightful and foresightful thinkers. They had a lot of understanding of human condition and how people thought and how people fought for power. And they did give us a lot of, I think, brilliant structures and the system of checks and balances that we have in the Constitution is a really brilliant design. Obviously, they were deeply flawed people too. They were human beings, and they believed that Black people could be enslaved, and they believed that women weren't equal to men, and they believed that even many of them didn't believe poor white people were equal to them. So the number of people who were even considered a part of the American polity, of the electorate in 1787, was a tiny fraction, right? And so I think that to them, with that mindset, adopting the Electoral College just didn't seem that weird. They battled over this question over the entire summer. It was one of the hardest things they had to decide. They fought on like 21 different days about how to choose the president. They held about 32, 33 separate votes on it. Some of them wanted Congress to choose the president. Other people said, no, if Congress chooses the president's going to be beholden to Congress, right? Some people wanted state governors to choose the president. One of the top framers at the convention, James Wilson from Pennsylvania, he was actually an immigrant from Scotland, but he lived in Pennsylvania. He argued from the opening till the end of the convention for a popular vote for president. And he gets James Madison on board, as I explained. He gets Gouverneur Morris on board. There were some of the most influential framers there wanted a popular vote. But even then, it was a popular vote would have been an extremely small proportion of the population. Today, with some important exceptions, like people with criminal records, every adult over the age of 18 is eligible to vote in elections. And it's just a completely different conception of democracy, and thus a completely different country than the one the framers were designing the Constitution for.
Was part of the thinking just like, we're not going to do what the British did, regardless of its effectiveness? We're just going to no king. We're going to take the U's out of words.
That's part of why the debate over how to choose the president was so fraught. Because remember, the Constitutional Convention was America 2.0. They had already tried to build a constitution. It was called the Articles of Confederation, and it was more of a contract among states, right? Not the system that we have today. And it didn't work. It collapsed in part because there was no strong central authority. There was no president. And they realized they couldn't even put down local rebellions, right? They didn't have a strong enough army. They had no power to tax. So when they met in 1787, you know, ostensibly what they were trying to do is, hey, let's fix the Articles of Confederation. But what was really happening was, you know what, we actually have to overhaul this entire thing. And so they start talking about, we need a national leader, a national executive on the order of the executives of states, governors. And then the question was, well, how do you choose that person? You don't want him to be a tyrant, like the guy we just fought a war to declare our independence from. But you also don't want him to be so feckless and unable to do anything that, you know, there's no, then you undermine the whole point of having a supreme national government. So those were some of the kind of cross currents happening at the convention. And it's what made the decision so difficult.
Can you talk about 1968, about a time in this country's history where we talked about actually getting rid of the Electoral College because of George Wallace? And as comedians, we have to say, not the incredible stand-up comedian George Wallace, but the very racist governor of Alabama, George Wallace.
And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Ooh, not funny! Not funny!
I'm shopping right here in Chicago today. I went shopping. I got that new credit card that Sears sent me. That new Discover card. And I already charged over $8,000 on it. And I discovered I can't pay it. Discover I don't live where I told him I live.
Come on, it's an easy. Which George Wallace is better? It's pretty easy.
I prefer the latter George Wallace.
For a second, that pause made me go, wait a minute, do I even know you?
This was in some ways my favorite part of the book, and it's largely because I had no idea this happened. You know, I was born a few years later, but even people who were politically active at the time have forgotten that it happened. It's gone down the American memory hole. But in the late 1960s, America came closer to abolishing the Electoral College and adopting a popular vote for president than it ever has in its history. And I'll tell you briefly how we got there. So there's a bunch of different things going on. Obviously, in the 1960s, American democracy is in a period of reformation, transformation, tumult that it rarely is. I think we are actually in another one of those moments right now. And
that's another reason
I wrote this book now, was because I think you have to grab the energy of those moments when they come, because they're not frequent. But in the 1960s, you have that string of rulings at the Supreme Court, the one person, one vote rulings. And that really, you can't underestimate how much that transformed American democracy, because it suddenly treated people in cities, which were obviously more racially and ethnically diverse, the same as the people in the rural areas, who had previously held hugely outsized power, right? They kept all the power to themselves, the, you know, white rural areas, over these growing cities. And so when you have one person, one vote, that basically makes the country a much more accurate representation. It makes Congress and state legislatures a much more accurate representation of the people who live there and what they want. Then you have the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, right? These were critically important federal laws that actually, for the first time in 100 years, made the 14th Amendment and the 15th Amendment come true. These were guarantees that had been kind of sitting there silently in hibernation for 100 years, that you had the right to vote no matter your race, that, you know, you enjoyed the equal protection of the laws. But there was no enforcement on the federal level of those amendments until 1964, 1965. And suddenly Black people throughout the South get a voice that they had been denied for, you know, 100 years since the end of the Civil War. Well, since the end of Reconstruction, so more like 80 years. But Jim Crow had effectively silenced Black people throughout the South. So those two things happening together, I think, had really gotten a lot of Americans thinking, what is this place we live in and whose voice counts in it? And people were really open, I think, for the first time in history, to a more expansive, more inclusive way of thinking about that. And then came the election that you just referenced, the 1968 election, in which you know, Richard Nixon and Hubert Humphrey are the you know, that's the marquee race. But the person who basically almost blows the whole thing up is George Wallace, right? George Wallace, the one I'm talking about, is the former Alabama governor, and he is a staunch segregationist, right? This guy is anti-civil rights. He's white supremacist to the core. And he jumps in the race because this is the moment at which the parties are switching, right? He was a Democrat when Democrats were the party of, you know, protect Jim Crow and,
Labels have changed, but
as things are switching, he's homeless. He has no party, right? The Republicans haven't absorbed him yet.
I don't know who to be racist for.
So he forms his own party, the American Independent Party, and he runs on a kind of brazenly racist, segregationist ticket. You know, as many people have said, Donald Trump is more sort of openly racist than anyone since George Wallace. I think, you know, that's actually a pretty good comparison. So Wallace knew he was not going to win the presidency outright. He didn't have support, that enough much support in the country. But he knew that the Electoral College had a special provision in it, which people still don't really know today, though they're starting to learn more about it, which is that if no candidate gets a majority of electoral votes, the election gets thrown into the House of Representatives. And the House of Representatives chooses the president, not by its membership, but by its state delegations. In other words, every state gets one vote. Wyoming gets one vote. California gets one vote. Even though California is 80 times the size of Wyoming. It's like the Senate, but worse, right? Yeah. So that provision is right there in the Constitution. There's no question that it exists. And George Wallace thought, you know what? If I can get just enough electoral votes to keep both Nixon and Humphrey from winning a majority, I throw this thing into the House, and then I have all the leverage. And basically, at that point, he could extort anything he wanted from either candidate to in exchange for his electors. So Wallace wins 5 Southern states, the Deep South. He wins them overwhelmingly. He wins 10 million votes, popular votes nationwide. And that translates into 46 electoral votes throughout the South. So it turns out not to be enough, right? Richard Nixon squeaks out a popular vote victory and a fairly comfortable electoral college victory. But the fact that Wallace was trying to do this freaked the country out. People were suddenly saying, wait a minute, this sort of unreconstructed racist is stepping into our presidential race, and he could basically determine how, you know, the next 4 years go, because he's going to extort all the kinds of promises that he wants to, you know, roll back the civil rights movement. No, thank you. And by 1968, 80% of Americans were on board with dumping the Electoral College and going with a popular vote. So it's an incredible story. Senator Birch Bayh of Indiana becomes the sort of, standard bearer of this movement. He spends 4 years basically trying to develop support for a popular vote amendment. And in 1969, the House of Representatives overwhelmingly passes an amendment to abolish the Electoral College. The vote was, it was 339 to 70. I mean, it wasn't even close, right? And it looked as though, you know, from state surveys, that there was very close to enough support for ratification in 38 states, which is what you need to get an amendment in the Constitution. So what is the last hurdle? It's the Senate, of course. As we know today, the Senate is where all good legislation goes to die. And the Senate blocks the amendment, right, that had passed the House. They basically dilly-dally on it. They use all kinds of parliamentary maneuvers to keep it from coming up to a vote. And then finally, in the middle of 1970, they filibuster it. Who runs the filibuster? Southern segregationists. Strom Thurmond, James Eastland, Sam Ervin, all the guys who are, they're descendants of slaveholders themselves. They tried to filibuster the Civil Rights Act, and they lost that. They're still angry about it.
Strom Thurmond, right? Who also famously had a secret black daughter.
Oh, of course. I'm sure most of them did. So, but really, that is what Southern segregationists, you know, the legacy of racial subjugation, of white supremacy, is threaded through the Electoral College's history from the beginning until today. And it's really just, it's shocking when I should say shocking, but not surprising when you realize it. But that effort in 1970 dies at the hands of the Southern segregationists in the Senate. It was end of September 1970, the last vote to try to kill the filibuster died. And with it, the last chance, really, I think, to amend the Electoral College out of the Constitution.
Whenever we talk about fixing the Electoral College, as you talked about, it would take a constitutional amendment. And a lot of people are like, hear that and they start to go, we can't do that. The Constitution is this perfect thing. We don't want to amend it too many times. We don't want to hurt its feelings. But the other way is a national popular vote interstate compact. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is one of the things about the Electoral College that I think people on the left and the right just don't really understand, which is that the fight that we have about the Electoral College and this thing that's in the Constitution is actually not about what's in the Constitution. It's about state-level laws that states have full authority to implement in order to make the Electoral College function. The Constitution itself says states can do this however they want. And one of those laws is about how states award their electors. So you know that, you know, every state in the country but two now awards its electors based on the winner-take-all rule. And that just means they give all of their electoral votes to the candidate who gets the most votes in their state. It doesn't have to be a majority, doesn't have to be, you know, any particular number. It could be narrow margin, it could be a wide margin. They get all the votes. And except in Nebraska and Maine, which do a different system. They use the congressional district system. This is how states do it. And this is the fundamental distortion caused by the modern Electoral College. It is not in the Constitution. States can do whatever they want. And that's what this interstate compact is. So an interstate compact is just, it's an agreement among states. It's a contract, basically, that states join to accomplish some end that, you know, they can't do through another means. There are dozens of them in effect right now. They work very well. The popular vote interstate compact works like this. States that join it agree to award all of their electors not to the winner of their statewide vote, but to the candidate who wins the most votes in all 50 states combined. So California is a member of the compact. If the compact were in effect, it would give all of its 55 electoral votes to whichever candidate, Republican or Democrat, won the most votes everywhere in the country combined. There are 15 states that have joined the compact now. They, and plus the District of Columbia, together they equal 196 electoral votes. The compact goes into effect once states representing a majority of electoral votes, 270 electoral votes, that's what you need to become president, right? That's the prize. Once states representing that number join, the compact takes effect. That's what it says by its own terms. So, you know, you put those two things together and then you realize, oh, the candidate who wins the most votes in the country will always become the president. Mm-hmm. That solves what I think is for most people the kind of fundamental insult of the Electoral College, which is that the person who wins the most votes can lose right now and has lost twice in the last 20 years. But, you know, I think it's a really interesting exercise. It's a really elegant way of using the Electoral College as the framers designed it to achieve an effective national popular vote.
Why would states do that? Why would they be willing to? How is it in their best interest to give up their control, their state's control to the popular vote? Like, I'd imagine for Ohio, it's like they feel great. Like, people give a shit about us every 4 years. We're Ohio. Why would they give that away? What is that, you know, than for the sake of democracy?
What you just described, that sort of question of self-interest among states, is really the core issue here. The reason winner-take-all is so bad is that it creates two kinds of states, right? And we all know these terms, safe states and battleground states. Most states are safe states. 40 to 45 states every year, every presidential election, are safe states. And all that means is that we know they're going to go for the Democrat or the Republican. There's nothing any candidate can do to change that. So they basically get ignored by both candidates. Nobody goes to them, nobody runs ads there. They don't care about the concerns that those voters have because they don't have to. The only states that matter, battleground states. So this year it's, you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, North Carolina, right? Those kinds of states, Florida. And when you only focus on the interests of a small number of voters, right, and even in those states, they only have to focus on small slivers of voters. They know which counties they need to win in order to win the whole state. It doesn't just distort campaigning. It distorts governance. Presidents of both parties, you know, enact policies, send out federal grant money to states in really distorted ways. They benefit the battleground states. So you are right that true battleground states do not have an incentive to join this, right? Because they now are the stars of the show. They get all the attention from both parties. The places that I think are going to be susceptible to it are both blue and red states. And this is a terminology that I hate because it's blue and red is just our way of saying winner take all, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like California has no Republican voters. You know, 4.5 million people voted for Donald Trump in California in 2016. That's bigger than most states.
Yeah.
Right?
I know. I live out here. I know, Jesse.
Yeah. Yeah. So, right. I mean, he has tons of Democrats in Texas, too. If Texas soon has majority of Democratic support, and Texas is going to give all 38 of its electors now, because it uses the winner-take-all law, to the Democrat, Republicans are all of a sudden going to say, wait a minute, I don't know about this Electoral College thing after all, because without Texas, Republicans have no path to the White House. They won Texas this year, and you know it's looking like they're going to lose the Electoral College. Without Texas, there's no chance. So I think it's a place like Texas that you might be able to go after and say, hey guys, you are going to be irrelevant as soon as this switches to the Democrats. So why don't you join this compact now? We count all the votes. Everybody matters equally, no matter where they live.
Hey, Jesse, thank you so much for joining us. We've been waiting to have this conversation for a while. Colorado passed a resolution saying that they'd give all their votes to whoever wins the popular vote. So we're one step closer to that, at least, if you give a shit about Colorado. but thank you so much, Jesse. We really do appreciate you being on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for the conversation.
Yeah, and thank you for letting me know how much extortion has been involved in electoral politics. I figured it was there, but I didn't know they actually talked about it out loud.
It's always about extortion.
Jesse Wegman is a member of the New York Times editorial board.
And his latest book is Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College.
And up next, we'll talk to our good friend Phoebe Robinson.
You know her from her podcast-turned-HBO series Two Dope Queens with her friend Jessica Williams, as well as her best-selling books You Can't Touch My Hair and Everything's Trash, But It's Okay.
We'll hear about everything she'd been up to in 2020. It's a lot. Phoebe Robinson is a comedian, best-selling author, and a podcast host.
This year, she started a publishing imprint called Tiny Reparations Books, started the new podcast Black Frasier, and is hosting Amazon's end-of-the-year comedy special, Yearly Departed.
And she still found time to talk to us. Let's get Phoebe in here.
Phoebe, thank you for being on Politically Reactive.
I mean, you know.
Is it weird to be like an official guest of us when we all like go back quite a bit?
Each other.
I was very excited. You know, I was like, of course, I would love to do this. And then now it's just like the election is such a clusterfuck that I am just like so done.
We don't need to start with the election. You know, we don't need to start. Okay. We could start with the fact that you generously bought my son a crib. It is the greatest gift I have ever received, even though it is for my child. It is beautiful. We haven't seen it in person yet because we're in San Diego, but I am very excited to open that box. It turns into a bed once he's in bed age, when he's ready to be in bed.
I love that you're such a new parent that you think that's amazing. It turns into a bed. Like you
it's
said it like
crib
it turns into
turns
a,
into a bed.
You said like the way you delivered it was like as if it turns into a Tesla. It turns into an electric car. Yeah, it's one of those convertible beds. I mean, the gift is amazing. I want to be clear. The gift is amazing. That's it's more amazing than what the bed turns into. Yeah.
It's like our dream
crib.
Well,
Hari picked it out. He picked it out. And I was like, I'll get you whatever you want. And he was like, no, like, do you really mean that? And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not? Like, I love babies. I think babies should have the best beds of all of us. You know what I mean? They have like no core strength or lumbar support really. So like they need like a really great foundation. And then he sent me the link to the crib and I was like, done, here you go. Don't even worry about it. So I'm so excited that it's there and I can't wait to see a picture of it.
I mean, how are you feeling about everything? Like things are crazy, but you're also like busy working. You have a new, imprint, Tiny Reparations, and like you're going to be headlining an Amazon comedy special soon, or whatever soon means, considering the state of the world. I mean, you have stuff that you're doing. How does one function and work while also dealing with like this?
Yeah. You know, this year is weird for everyone, and You know, I think it comes in waves. Like, sometimes I feel highly productive, and other times I'm just, like, over it, and I don't want to work. And, you know, I think whenever I do get in the mode of, like, working, I always try to think about, like, the stuff that I'm doing, if it's more than just, like, a fun thing to create, but if it's actually going to have an impact. So, like, with the imprint, it was kind of, like, always my dream to sort of have an imprint. You know, I'd always, like, remember hearing about, like, you know, how Toni Morrison edited books while she was writing. And I was like, oh, that seems like a lot of work. I think I would just rather have my own imprint. Like, I thought that that would be, like, less work to, like, run an imprint than to edit. And it's, like, actually way more. But, like, using this imprint, it's, like, it's, you know, the we've acquired 5 books so far. Wow. I think 2 of them we announced and 3 of them we haven't announced yet. But it's been really great to sort of, like, have this platform for women, people of color, queer people, like, just to have a space where they're not going to feel marginalized. I remember when I was shopping around my first book in 2015, like, so many people were just saying, were just passing on me and saying, like, no one wants to read an essay collection written by a Black woman. This is too niche. This is, like, not relatable. Just, like, all these things. And this was 2015. Mm-hmm. I want to be a place where people feel like they won't be judged based on, like, what they look like or who they are, and, like, I will just give them a shot. And so I think that's been the most exciting thing that I've been working on. And it's really because I feel like I'm doing something that's not just for myself, but for and with other people.
And why Tiny Reparations?
So it's also the name of my production company, which was kind of, like, started as a joke when Jess and I were doing 2 Dope Queens. And, you know, I would always just be like, anytime something, like, good happened that was minor with, like, a Black person. So say, like, you know, Verizon's like, oh, your monthly bill is now $20 lower. I'm like, oh, that's a tiny reparation. Cause, like, I know we're not, I know I'm not going to get the cash or, like, the money, like, in the long term, like, all the big stuff that we're trying to get, but, like, the small things, like, every sort of, like, bonus in life is, I consider a tiny reparation. And I was like, well, that could be sort of what this imprint is. It's, like, my way of sort of, like, giving back and helping out. And I don't know. I'm really excited about it. So I hope that people like the books. It's always scary. It's so scary. Yeah.
First of all, Phoebe, I believe we will get some form of reparations in our lifetime that are big reparations.
You do?
So I do.
Do you have a dollar amount in your head or no?
For me personally, what I will settle for? Yes, I do. For the whole team of Black folks? No, I don't have
a... Yeah.
But I mean,
that would be incredible. Yeah.
Something's going to happen. I think something's going to happen. That's a separate conversation that we have to have off Politically Reactive, because we have white people who listen to this, and I don't know that I trust all of them. I think one of the things you're talking about, which is so important here, and I feel this too as a Black person in showbiz, quote unquote. I say that because I work for a news network, which feels weird to say you're in showbiz, but that it's not just about getting through the door yourself, because if you're in there and if you get through the door and you're the only Black person in there and you look around, you can't get everything done you need to get done, even in your own career. And then at some point you're like, well, I'm here and I've been here for a minute. I need to bring other people through here with me. And I think a lot of times in my mind, I thought you had to be like a huge superstar like Beyonce before you started doing that. But then you learn once you're in there, like every individual you get through the door makes a big difference.
I mean, there are some people who just do want to be at the mountaintop by themselves because and that's how they can feel exceptional. But I'm sort of like, that's kind of missing the point. You know, it's like if you want things to change, like it has to change for more than just you. It has to change for everybody. You know, I was thinking back to like late spring when that hashtag on Twitter was going, publishing paid me, where people really were saying, okay, this is what I got for my advance. And then you could just see sort of like the difference where, like, you know, these accomplished like authors of color were just kind of getting crap sort of deals. And then these like debut white authors would be getting like $500,000 sort of advance. And I'd be like, oh yeah, I never made that money back for my publisher, but I got another chance to do like book 2. And so like just that hashtag really sort of changed things. And I noticed that even when we're bidding on books now, like compared to like what I got for my first book to now what someone can get for their first book as a person of color, it is so different. And like, it feels like, okay, I can actually like write this book, set aside time and actually do it. Because, you know, my advance was 50,000. Which, well, if you take out lawyer fees, you take out taxes, you take out your lit agent, you're maybe getting 50% of that. It's like, okay, well, I still have to have like all these other like freelance gigs because I can't live off of $25,000 for like a year and a half in New York City. So it's just like, it's almost like you're getting paid like not enough to do the thing that you love. So I'm glad that that sort of financially is changing now.
Yeah, I think people don't realize that, like, you know, you see that advance money and you go, and somebody who doesn't write books goes, $50,000, what are you complaining about? But then it's like, yeah, but that's supposed to be the pay to write the book. And like you said, once you take all those other things out, it's like, man, I'm going to need to get a part-time job to support my book writing habit. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. And certainly I've been a person who has seen those big advance go to people. And then I wrote a book and I went in there like, I can't wait to see. Oh, okay. That's fair. No, that's fair. Yeah. No. No, you're right. It's totally fair. It's totally fair. Yeah.
Would you ever write another book, or are you just so like you did it once and you're like, I'm good?
So that's thank you for asking that question. It's complicated. One, my answer was always no, because it was super hard. And I didn't have the time. I was envisioned writing a book going, well, you see your friends who are like professional writers who are like, I'm going to be off social media for the next 18 months and I'm going to be moving to a cabin in the woods while I write my book. And so I always envisioned that. But yeah. I didn't envision the thing you said about like, okay, the money is the money, but also, especially if you're like, when I got my book, I only had one season of United Shades, and they wanted me to turn around pretty quickly because I felt like they were like, we don't know if you're going to get to two seasons of United Shades. So, and so the schedule was such that I was filming United Shades and writing the book. Yeah, and so people will quote me things from my book and I'll be like, oh, that's good. Who wrote that? Or I'll be like, that doesn't sound that good. Who wrote that? Oh, that was me too. Like, it's just sort of like, I don't think I would, I think I would wait until like sort of like the end. I'm going to write at the end of my life when I write like a 15 volume thing about like the history of W. Kamau Bell.
But ooh. Okay. Not, like the Barack Obama like presidential years.
Yeah, yeah.
That's 717 pages for the first volume? If this was anybody else, I would not be that bullshit. Straight up.
And he's already written two books. Like, yeah, so it's not. He already told us about when I was a kid. Oh, that's funny. Bye-bye. I mean, I heard that now. And plus, I mean, the thing about it, and I look forward to reading it and also look forward to having him on the show because I'm sure he's going to say yes when we ask. It's not going to be like a 700-page diss track. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like he's going to. I don't think it's going to get super spicy. This motherfucker over here.
That would be amazing if he just was like, fuck it, I'm dragging everyone to filth. I'm exposing everyone's secrets, just blowing up his own life. Like, that would be amazing.
Fuck that cop who did that to Henry Louis Gates. Yeah. Yeah. It was Biden's dumb idea to invite him to the White House. Fuck that guy that interrupted my State of the Union.
If I see that guy, it's on site. Right. Me and the Secret Service are throwing hands.
Like, we all feel this need to bring other people with us. I mean, does that ever get exhausting? Because the thing is, like, white people don't have to think about that shit. They're like, I'm going to hire my friend. Or like, who did Harvard push out this year from the Lampoon? You know what I mean? Like, there's this, it's a conveyor belt. But for us, I think we have to make really deliberate decisions. Do you ever think like, God, I would like to work with that white person, but they're white and there's so many other people of color that I could work with that would like be a bigger opportunity? Like, do you ever have to like think between creatively what you're thinking about or interested in versus like what as a culture we need?
That's a great question. I've never gotten that before. And that is so good. You know, I think it's a combination. I mean, you know, I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I'm usually not considered for most things that like Ivy League people would be considered for. So I think my instinct is always to sort of like look in the places that are often ignored and sort of like engage with the people who aren't given the opportunity, even though they have the skill sets that would, they would shine so much in a particular job, but because they didn't go to Stanford, like no one's going to talk to them. I just want to make sure that whatever I'm putting out there has something to say. And it's not that I'm opposed to working with white people. Like I'm not, my boyfriend's white. So that is like my biggest collaboration of my life is with my boyfriend. So I'm clearly not anti, you know, working with white people, but I think I just want to be, I think what I try to keep in the back of my mind is like, is the quality there? Cause I think a lot of times with people of color or queer people, like, the standards are very high. So if someone is getting that job, it's because they have proven themselves like time and time and time again. And I feel like the standards are lower sometimes in the hiring process with white people. I know, like, for instance, with the talk show that I'm working on for Comedy Central, when I was like, okay, all right, Comedy Central, like, send me like a bunch of names for like story producers and blah, blah, blah. And they just sent me all white people. And I was like, guys, I'm not going to start interviewing the I'm not going to start the interviewing process until this is a diverse sort of pool that I can hire from. And sometimes it gets annoying that you have to explicitly say that, but I think there's a lot of just, I guess, unconscious bias, if you want to try and put it that way. Maybe some racism, although I don't even think in that, I just think people just don't think to sort of do what's different than what has been done before them. I understand why sometimes Hollywood is very slow about things, but I'm also like, y'all are just being ignorant. And if you're not gonna help push things further, then you should just step aside, because it's at the end of the day, it's too tiring for the three of us to have to like constantly explain things. It's like, can we just get someone in here who knows what the fuck is going on? Wouldn't that just be great? You know what I mean? Where you don't have to have this conversation like every 2 months.
Just sort of flashed me. Just imagine if they had just given us all that Quibi money, just the three of us, and said, figure it out. I'm pretty sure we could have come up with some good ideas. That would have lasted Quibi. Longer like, than
like
3 months.
Like, not do Quibi. Don't do Quibi. That's the
Quibi. How about programs in 10-minute chunks? You mean like everything on the internet? Yeah, except you're paying for it. Okay, tell me more. One thing I've always loved about what you do, Phoebe, is, you know, there is a pressure, I think, as people of color to address like the struggles of our communities. And it's not to say that's not valid and that we both don't do that in different ways, but you also are able to share more of yourself, like whether it's like Two Dope Queens or whether it's, you know, one of the first things I saw you do, which was Blaria, Black Daria, which was your blog and a podcast. And now you have Black Frasier. First of all, like, is that really intentional? Like, I'm not going to be pigeonholed in this way. So I'm going to like, you know, I'm going to claim Daria because that's part of my experience too. Is that very intentional? And secondly, tell us about Black Frasier.
Okay, so Black Frasier is my new podcast. Once we were all just sort of stuck indoors and there were all the social uprisings and everyone was losing their jobs and things were just really getting wild and sort of nutty, I was kind of like, I feel like I need to talk. You know, I love always having like a fun little title, and I've never seen Frasier.
Oh my God.
Never seen it. Yeah. I just know the theme song, and my boyfriend loves Frasier. He's actually watched the entire series twice, which I know is a lot of episodes. But I like to give advice, sometimes solicited or unsolicited. And so we're just joking around that I'm kind of like a Black Frasier. And so that's like how we ended up with the title. Whether it's like family stuff, politics, you know, comedy, what have you, I just feel like it's a really like fun way to have a conversation with someone, and then we just answer audience questions at the end, and everyone's been really nice. It's been so good. I'm really like waiting for like a bad episode, and it hasn't happened yet. I'm just like, what am I gonna shit the bed on this? And it hasn't so I'm like, thank God, maybe next year. But this year feels like really good. And I think my favorite episode was probably the one that I did with Michelle Obama, because it was really nice to just, I always get nervous whenever I talk to her because she's just so funny and smart and incredible and perfect. And to have her like talk about voting and her history with it and just like, you know, really encouraging young people. I was just kind of like, she is what everyone should aspire to be like, because she's just, she gets it. She's so giving. She's so smart and so caring. I just, she's just a hero. She's great.
Well, that segues into our last question. We can't talk to you without talking about Michelle Obama. And I think this is, you know, I've known you for years now, but, you know, not forever, but I do feel like you're a person I have a stake in. And so when I see you succeed, I'm like, yay. And to see you with Michelle Obama, I was just like, you know, glory tear, as we say. just like, because I, you know, to know that not only have you found your way in this career, which doesn't want any person outside of the norm to find the norm, but also everybody wants to sit next to Michelle Obama. Everybody wants to, even people who don't like her, we kind of like to get a selfie. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so talk about that relationship. You know, like, what is it like? And are you, can you just text her G-U-U-U-R-L, girl? Is it there?
I mean, it is one of those things where sometimes I think about, I'm like, is this something that's really happened in my life, or did I just make it all up? Because it just seems so absurd. And I mean, this all started 2018, 19, whatever. I don't know what time it is, but when Jess and I were, before we did the Tito Queens for HBO, we had the podcast, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, we were doing the podcast with WNYC, and they hit us up and they're like, hey, you know, Michelle Obama reached out to us and wants to, you know, be a guest on your show so she can promote her book, Becoming. And I was like, wait, she's listened to this podcast? I've talked about hot dudes' penises way too much. If I had known that, I would have been way more intelligent. I was just like, what the hell? And so I was really nervous, and I just like, I read her book and I took all these notes, and then you meet her and it's like, oh, she's like, she's a real person. She's really chill. Like, I always say this. I think she is, of any like legitimately famous person that I met, like, she's the only person who did not want to be famous. Like, she just wants to do public service and like make people's lives better, but she's not out here like trying to, like, you know, do thirst trap posts or like, could you imagine her doing a thirst trap post? No. You know what I mean? Like, she's just a real person who just wants the world to be better than what it was that she grew up in. And so to have someone like her be so encouraging and get what I'm trying to do, and be supportive, it really sort of, I'm so grateful for it. And I just don't know what I did to deserve it, but I'm just trying so hard to not like screw it up. I don't text her that much because I don't want to like bother her. But every once in a while, I'll just like send her like a cute little message, and she always gets back to me like really like quickly. And I'm like, oh, that's nice that she's taking that time to like, I'm really bad at texting, but she like makes me feel like I'm actually important in her life. So that's cool.
Did you text her since the election? Like, where, like, since it started?
I haven't. Well, here's the thing about the election. I was like, I knew this was going to be like final season of Game of Thrones. I knew it was going to be a fucking disaster. poorly written, a disaster, a lot of hype. I think because I'm trying to just like put myself in a bubble when it comes to the election, I didn't like hit up Mish. But I think when Biden wins, then I'll text her and be like, girl, can you believe it?
Wait, did you just say hit up Mish?
Yeah, hit up Mish. Oh, that's her nickname. It's Mish.
Hit up Mish. Okay.
Wait, did she know your work through from like Sasha Malia? Like, was that it? Like,
podcast was on No, I'll take this one. Her podcast was on WNYC. She wasn't doing it on Transistor Radio. She wasn't on TikTok or Vine. She was on a major. Have you heard of WNYC, Hari?
Yeah, but it's still. There's a podcast.
Michelle Obama. Let me go. I got it. Don't worry about it. Michelle Obama's black, a black woman. She is certainly connected to major media. A podcast in New York City is hosted by two black women. Michelle Obama having interest in black women specifically, and also everyone generally, probably went, let me check this out. Phoebe dropped a hot big peen joke, and she was like, ah, shit. And then she was a fan. I don't know why this had to come any other way. It wasn't. Do you think she found out through her daughters? He goes on Vine.
I love your impression of Michelle Obama's impression to Phoebe's hot tea show.
And we pretty much guaranteed we won't get Brock for that interview now. So.
No, you're good.
Phoebe, thank you for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. We could talk all day.
Thanks for having me. This was so fun. Fingers crossed that this country gets back on track. Well,
yeah, we know.
I don't know what back on track means, but you know.
on a track that then we can figure out where the right track is. Yes.
Exactly. Yep.
You're the best, Phoebe. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Stay safe, y'all.
Phoebe Robinson, Dearly Departed, the Amazon end-of-year comedy special Phoebe is hosting, comes out on December 30th.
And don't forget to check out her podcast, Black Frasier.
And we'll end the show by checking in with Megan Hatcher-Mays about all the things Democrats can do, even without a Senate majority.
Hey, I'm not giving up on that Senate majority yet. Megan Hatcher-Mays is Director of Democracy Policy at Indivisible.
It's a grassroots movement of thousands of local groups with a mission to elect progressive leaders, rebuild our democracy, and defeat the Trump agenda.
Trump may be defeated, but his agenda is alive and well, so we wanted to talk to Megan about what comes next.
Megan Hatcher-Mays, thank you for being unpolitically reactive. We have known each other a very long time from our days living in Seattle, Washington.
We have a mutual
close friend in Lindy West.
That's right.
Who is married to my writing partner, Ahmefele J. Oluo.
Two legends.
Two legends. And we are legends adjacent.
That's right. That's the best I can hope for, I think.
So the first thing is, you know, Trump has filed all these lawsuits against states that he is losing in, and some he's worried he might lose in. And of course, there will be lawyers dispatched on the left to prevent him from stealing the election. First of all, how likely is it that he can steal the election through the courts? And secondly, as regular people, is there anything else we can do right now?
That's starting off strong. Yes. So I've got good news on the question of whether or not it's likely that Donald Trump is going to steal the election through the courts. And I think it's pretty unlikely, actually. But this was a concern of mine, earlier this month when the Senate kind of rammed through Amy Coney Barrett, confirmed her to the Supreme Court, like while votes were being counted. She was ultimately confirmed 8 days before Election Day. It was really messy. And Donald Trump was very explicit that the reason he wanted her on the court so badly was so that she could deliver him a W if the election was close. It does not look like she's going to get the chance to do that, which is good. As far as I have seen, there is no Bush v. Gore style scenario percolating out there somewhere that where a race is so close in a state that would decide the election, where even if the Supreme Court ruled in one state that they needed to stop the count, I don't think that would be fatal to Joe Biden's chances at getting to 270. Donald Trump should not have any real success in sort of overturning votes that we already know have been counted. He's behind by tens of thousands of votes in Michigan and Wisconsin. Even in a recount count situation, we've never had a situation with a recount even where that many votes have been magically found and a person has overcome tens of thousands of votes. And there doesn't really seem to be an avenue for the Supreme Court to overturn this election.
I mean, is there anything else we average people can do in this situation to make sure Biden wins, or are we just, you know, waiting on the hands of fate to decide?
First of all, Ari, I'm just making sure, are you actually talking about like voter fraud? Like, is there anything we can do as individuals to go in like in sort of Ocean's 11 style heist?
Lie, cheat, steal. Is there anything we can do? No, but is there anything else that we can do? Because it's just so frustrating to watch the television and you see the votes come in and you keep hearing about these court cases. And it's like, we can do something, right? Or do we just wait? That's all we can do is wait?
So what is going to be really important up until the moment he leaves office is to make sure he actually leaves office. And there is actually something that we can do to ensure that that happens. Indivisible has partnered up with a bunch of folks to launch a campaign called Protect the Results. And we've already seen some activation of that over the last, or right after the election, where people really wanting to make sure that every single vote is counted and that Republicans are not successful in throwing out thousands and thousands of ballots. So if people want to get involved with that, they can go to protecttheresults.com and they can, that's kind of where we're monitoring the crazy things that Donald Trump says. And depending on how serious it is, that would be a situation where we'd want to activate to really send a message to Donald Trump, to Republicans, anybody who's thinking about becoming an accomplice to a sort of Trumpian coup, that we have our eyes on them. And that is true for the courts too. So if the courts are impacted by public sentiment as well. And so it's going to be really important to send the message to every branch of government that the people are not going to accept a situation where Donald Trump has clearly lost the election and he is refusing to leave office.
White House squatting is not allowed.
That's correct. I mean, honestly, it's like, I guess if he just wants to stay in the building, that's fine. At the end of the day, I mean, like, I think Joe Biden could find a place in DC if he needed one.
Joe Biden
in DC looking for a place to house. This would make a lovely White House.
That's right. But at the end of the day, the question
two
is
two bedrooms, three baths.
At the end of the day, the question is, whose hand is on the Bible on January 20th, 2021? That's the president. It doesn't really matter where the person lives, but ideally we get him out. He goes back to his gaudy penthouse in New York and we don't really have to think about him much.
I kind of love the idea of leaving him in the White House, letting him think that he's actually still the president, and actually just making the wall they built around the White House before the election just taller and making it connect at the top so it's like a dome, and just be like, yeah, you're still the president. Of course you're the president. You're in the White House. Like,
so, exactly.
Just let Joe Biden go across town and do it from a nice loft apartment.
That's right. I have an extra bedroom if Joe Biden need a place to stay. The rates are very fair.
So there's two scenarios here. If the Georgia elections, the runoffs, work in the Democrats' favor, what is the policy agenda then? What are the key things that Democrats are going to focus on? If that does not happen, if the Republicans maintain their majority and turtle face McConnell is still in power, what do we do? Can anything get passed?
If Republicans maintain control of the Senate, the next 2 years are going to look, as far as getting stuff done, things are going to look a lot like they have over the last two. I know Joe Biden believes this, that he can bring everybody to the table and come up with some sort of bipartisan compromise. I'm less convinced of that because I don't know if maybe Joe Biden doesn't remember this, but, you know, McConnell in 2008 very famously was like, we're going to make Barack Obama one-term president by blocking every single thing he wants to do. So I don't think that instinct goes away just because a different Democrat is the president now. Although there are a lot of pressing things that affect everybody, including Republican constituents, and that includes coronavirus relief, economic relief. And so those are areas where I think there are opportunities for some sort of compromise. It will be really complicated, though, if Democrats don't win those runoff elections in Georgia in January. If we do, still a challenging path, because just to remind everyone, we have a lot of bad Democrats in our caucus still.
Wait, what?
I know. Red alert siren.
Some Democrats aren't as good as others? I'll slow down, Megan. I don't know.
Unfortunately, Joe Manchin is still in the United States.
Oh, Joe Manchin.
Never forget. So it's still a challenge, but we have a lot more possibilities, and that's where I think the grassroots really has a lot of opportunities to really put give positive reinforcements to Democrats who might be scared of big ideas. But that narrow of an advantage, like a 50-50 with a Vice President Harris as the tiebreaker, that tells you everything you need to know about how badly our democracy was designed in the first place. It should not be that close. So in a situation where it's 50-50 with a vice presidential tiebreaker, Democrats really need to start looking around and saying, we actually do have a mandate. The numbers in the Senate don't tell the full story of where the rest of the country is at. And so what are we going to do to fix this problem? Making DC the 51st state is a great one, because that makes the Senate more representative. Right now, 700,000 people in DC have no voting representation in Congress at all. That begins to sort of fix this problem so that every election isn't such a nail biter, and so that frankly, the popular party actually has the ability to govern. Like, that's the way that it should work. Like, if millions of people vote you into office, you have a mandate. That's how it works. So I think that'll be the opportunity for the grassroots to be able to make that case to more moderate Democrats, more conservative Democrats. You really do have a mandate, and this is what we're looking for.
I remember when George W. Bush won, I think even against Gore, he said he had a mandate. Even when it was the fact that the Supreme Court was like, we're going to give it to you. He's like, mandate! I feel like, isn't this part of the problem that Democrats just, is it low self-esteem or being bullied in high school? I don't know. Like, I'm talking about Democrat leadership, not regular Democrats down here. But, like, because I heard a good friend of yours on CNN, Hurry, Rick Santorum.
Stop he was saying stuff like that. He is not.
Okay, you just spend, you just holiday with his family sometimes.
That's not true.
Yeah, yeah. We all know that.
Hurry, yes, it is.
Yeah. Just, I had to let the people know. He was sort of saying that, like, the fact that the race is so tight is basically gives Joe Biden cover for not having to sort of like play to the progressive wing of the party. Like, now he was basically like, there's no way we're going to have expand the court. There's no way we're going to have DC statehood. And he was sort of going like, basically like, good for you, Joe Biden. You got what you want. You can be a moderate. And yeah. I was a little bit like, first of all, fuck you, Rick Santorum, every day of the week and twice on Sundays. Second of all, that might be kind of true about how Joe Biden feels about it.
The issue with Democrats is, I think a lot of Democrats currently in leadership kind of came of age politically when Carter lost to Reagan in 1980. And so the lesson that they took from that is, if we win, nobody make any sudden movements. Nobody do anything. You know, like, because we might lose if anybody does anything. But the lesson... But then they don't do anything, and then everyone gets mad, and then they lose. And so they never seem to... So we're kind of stuck in this sort of old way of thinking about politics. But then also, the way that Bill Clinton won has really informed the way a lot of older Democrats think about how politics works. The way that Bill Clinton won was basically by running as a Republican. Like, he was like, we're going to reform welfare, and we're going to do all this stuff, and Super be predator. Republicans, basically. Yeah. And so I think that's how a lot of Democrats still think about politics. And I think we saw that play out in this race where Joe Biden, you know, gave Michael Bloomberg a prime speaking spot at the DNC. John Kasich came in and he leaned a lot on these like Republican validators as to why he should be the president. But we saw from the numbers that we've seen so far from this election, that didn't work. It does not work to try to pivot to the middle and try to convince Republicans that you're not a socialist. It just doesn't work. I think, in fact, the share of Republicans who voted for Donald Trump increased by 3 points since 2016. So the lesson truly, I think, that Democrats need to learn from this election is it's okay to do stuff. It's okay to have big ideas. You know, even Fox News is showing polls that show the majority of people support Medicare for all. The majority of people support increasing the minimum wage. The majority of people think that abortion should be legal. That's across the board. That's not just Democrats. That's American voters. So it's okay to lean into those things that our side it leads on. Those are issues that we lead on: economic justice and reproductive rights and, you know, healthcare. Those are issues that Democrats are supposed to be good at. So lean into those things instead of fussing so much about whether or not Colin Powell's going to endorse you. I mean, it doesn't matter. It doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference to Republican voters. And maybe it does for independents. But Democrats could get like 99% of the vote from their vote share from people on the left and 1% from the Republicans. And they'd be like, how are we going to shore up our Republican support?
Part of it is that the Democratic leadership almost feels more comfortable with like those moderate Republicans, because they're more like those moderate Republicans than they are like the far left of the party. They're more comfortable with those ideas. They're more comfortable with compromise. Like, they don't want to get pushed further left. They're not. That's not where. Well, it's like, also they're another generation.
They're also they all hang out together at the same restaurants and country clubs and and fancy dinners. And that's the thing that, I mean, I sort of realized. You know, you'll see those people sort of like mad at each other on TV, but then later, like, it's the. I mean, I hate to... It's the Dianne Feinstein.
I was just going to say.
Yep. You say it. You say.
The hug heard round the world. you know, yeah. I mean, and this came up with, like, Brett Kavanaugh, too, where, you know, he got some liberal validators to say, oh, he should be a Supreme Court justice. And we find out later, you know, they know each other from the country club, literally. Mm-hmm. That's how they know each other. Mm-hmm. And the same is true for institutionalist Democrats, people who have been in office for forever. That includes Dianne Feinstein, who has been in the Senate for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, they start to think of the opposition party as just, they think of it as a game. And it's not a game for people who are not senators. Yes. You know, it's not chess. It's people's real life. Dianne, what a mess. I mean, the hearings were not great from the get-go. I think there were a lot of good
messages. And we're talking about the Amy Coney Barrett.
Amy Coney Barrett, yes. So during the Amy Coney Barrett hearings, there was a lot of good messages with not very many good messengers. And then you had Dianne Feinstein and Dick Durbin of Illinois apologizing to Amy Coney Barrett for like the vitriol of this process and apologizing to her kids. It's like, you do not need to do this. No Republican will ever sit down and apologize to like Sonia Sotomayor for not holding
the door for her. They'll be like, get it yourself.
They don't care. Yeah. So, and then for her to cap things off by telling Lindsey Graham, now again, just to refresh everyone's memory, jamming through a Supreme Court nominee who will serve on the bench for life 8 days before Election Day, while votes are being cast, and the whole confirmation process took about 30-something days. That's like the shortest time frame ever, as close to an election as we've ever done it. And Dianne Feinstein turns to Lindsey Graham, and both of these people wearing no mask. Mm. And she says, this is the best hearing I've ever been a part of.
Oh.
And then they hug.
Yep.
And then she hugged him. And it's, I don't, that's the least helpful thing I can imagine a Democrat doing in this era of all eras. It was so deeply unhelpful. And in fact, I strongly believe that it let Susan Collins off the hook for her bad vote on Kavanaugh and gave Susan Collins permission to vote no and basically laundered Susan Collins's reputation in Maine, because then Susan Collins could say, see, even the top Democrat on this committee thinks these hearings were fair. So I digress a little bit, but what, even if we don't win back the Senate, there's a lot we can do as Democrats to show the American people that we are serious about the problems facing our democracy. And one of the things that we can do is put good Democrats in charge of the most important stuff. And one of the most important things is our courts. Republicans have figured this out. It has been a 40-plus year project of theirs to turn the courts into an arm of the Republican Party. They have, up to this point, been successful without much interference from the left. That is starting to change, but it's never going to change if you have people like Dianne Feinstein in charge of the committee with jurisdiction over the courts. Hugging Lindsey Graham is about as much evidence as you need to show she's not up to the task.
To try to be proactive before you leave, a couple of questions. First, you talked about D.C. becoming a state, mm-hmm. and you talked about court expansion. Are there other pro-democracy initiatives that we should be pushing forward? And secondly, how do you get the average person to care? Because it's hard enough to get people to register and vote every 4 years for the president, not even local elections. You're asking them to try to understand really specific, like, this has to go, otherwise none of this matters. Or mm-hmm. you really need to vote in that runoff election in Georgia, mm-hmm. or bad things are going to happen. Like, how do you get people into something when it feels complex? When it's not necessarily complex, but it feels complex.
It does feel complex. That's why I'm so happy to work at Indivisible, because it's really our bread and butter, is like taking these issues that feel really complex and letting people know that, first of all, it's okay if, you know, you don't need to be like an election law expert to understand how important this is. That's okay. We want to meet you where you're at and try to explain this to the best of our ability. And we've been really successful in doing that, you know, getting people involved on issues that you would not necessarily think, you know, the average person would really care so much about. Like, we shifted, you know, our movement on ending the filibuster of all things over the last year. That went from being pretty unpopular amongst our groups to being really popular amongst our groups, especially if we end up eking out a win in the Senate. People want to know stuff. That's what we discovered under Trump, is that people didn't really pay much attention. And then they were like, wait, what is this? Is this allowed? Can the president do that? And so people really want to know. And so that's been really great. We have like a willing audience that like really wants to know what's going on and then really wants to take what they've learned and do something about it. And so that part feels really, really good and really, really exciting. And democracy, we always hear from Indivisibles, is their top priority. And so that is why it is our top organizational priority. That's why we pursue democracy reform as our number one issue, is because it matters the most to our groups, to really answer your question. In addition to making DC the 51st state, and in addition to fixing the courts, there is a bill that passed the House this year that I think we're going to, that Democrats are going to introduce right away at the start of next Congress. It's called the For the People Act. It's HR 1, which signals it is a top priority of House Democrats, which is very good. And that bill includes expanded voting rights, election security, campaign finance reform. So, you know, public financing, sorts of things that would kind of undermine the influence of the Citizens United decision. Really good stuff in that bill. So we're going to be fighting really hard to get that bill passed in the House as quickly as possible, and ideally through the Senate. Makes my life a lot easier if we win those runoff elections in Georgia, by the way, to get, because even the most basic democracy reforms, Mitch McConnell has called full bore socialism. So help me out, Georgia.
I mean, I guess it's kind of exciting to know that, like, after the presidential election, Georgia's going to be like a total, like,
yeah,
like a shit show. Like, it's going to be a democracy shit show. Hopefully we come out on the other side with democracy. But yeah,
speaking of renting apartments, I think Barack Obama is probably just going to get a place down there. And spend the next 2 months just being like, please, please, please.
Megan Hatcher-Mays is Director of Democracy Policy at Indivisible.
Learn about Indivisible and how you can connect with your local chapter at indivisible.org. I'm not going to spell it for you because I'm Indian and I don't want you to judge me.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Jesse Wegman, Phoebe Robinson, and Megan Hatcher-Mays.
Keep tweeting and Facebooking us your comments and questions using the hashtag PoliticallyReactive.
Or leave us a message at 917-477-6525. That's 917-477-6525.
Kamau and I are both on the internet, Twitter and Instagram, at Hari Kondabolu and at W. Kamau Bell. We both have Netflix specials, and if you'd like to hear more of me, you can go to WTF with Mark Maron, where I do a full episode. It is very good.
And unlike Hari, who's just promoting his own capitalistic interests,
is 2 months old. We need the money.
I'd like to promote democracy and saving it. Go to gasenate.com so you can donate or figure out ways to support the election of Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff.
Politically Reactive is a production of Topic Studios and Warner Media Podcast Network. Executive producers are Maria Zuckerman and Christy Gressman.
And Hari Kondabolu.
And His Majesty W. Kamau Bell. The show is produced by Matt Martin and Malachi Seeger-Sakir. Will Stanton engineers and mixes the show.
And thanks, as always, to Brontez Purnell for providing music for the show. And thanks for listening to Politically Reactive.
Much love to Four Seasons Total Landscaping. Not funny!
You say he wasn't funny, but he was killing. Now, just to be clear, was that George Wallace the comedian or the racist governor of Alabama? I'm not sure which. I'm not familiar with all of George Wallace's material.
He was doing some character work, Kamau.
He was edgy. He was edgy when he was younger.
By the way, George Wallace has the best Twitter account. Not the racist, yes, but the comedian. The racist is dead, thank God.
No, the racist's Twitter account is actually just Donald Trump runs it.
Right. It's a fan page.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii.